The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul. My guest is Ron Temple. He is Managing Director and Co-Head of Multi-Asset Investing at Lazard Asset Management, which recently announced the launch of a Lazard Real Assets Fund. We asked Ron Temple to join us and tell us about the decision to launch the fund as well as how that fund will be managed. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Why did Lazard decide to create this new real assets fund? What is the purpose in the greater scheme of things with what's going on at Lazard?
So this is a strategy. We've actually been running the real assets strategy for about 2 years now. And we decided to launch the fund because in our discussions basically with prospects in the U.S. and outside of the U.S., we found that there was an increasing amount of interest in the topic of inflation. And so we felt that this is something that, if we step back and think about the different kinds of problems clients need to solve, one of them is how to protect their purchasing power against the risk of inflation. And we were seeing meaningful interest in terms of the clients and also seeing signs that we thought it was reasonable and appropriate for clients to be looking at their inflation risk, given some cyclical and structural things we're watching in the markets.
So the press release did mention that as part of the existing real assets strategy. Now, let's talk about the definition of real assets, because there are alternatives, and we tend to think of real assets as a subset of alternatives, and our big areas of focus are real estate, energy, infrastructure, and commodities. How do you define real assets? Are they hard assets, or do they extend beyond just plain hard assets?
So effectively, the real assets we're investing in here, and just to be very clear, we're not buying physical assets. We're buying financial assets that are based on physical assets or based on real assets. So to put that another way, we're investing in a few different areas. Number one is companies that are basically listed infrastructure companies. So we tend to think of that as preferred infrastructure, so it can range from railways, utilities, other parts of infrastructure. Number two is we're investing in REITs. So again, real estate is underpinning this investment, but it is real estate investment trust that we're investing in. Number three is we're investing in the commodity space. In commodities, we're going to be investing in futures and also in companies that are directly involved in the commodity space. And then fourth, we have inflation-linked bonds. And fifth, we're investing in companies that have basically have historically proven empirically that they have the ability to pass through price increases. So we call these companies that have evidence of basically taking advantage of pricing opportunities. And so if you look at the different categories, they're generally based on real assets, but are indeed financial securities that are based on those.
So that's one of the other things I found interesting about the fund and I wanted to ask you about is that it's completely liquid. Why? It doesn't sound like you're doing any private equity investing. You're not seeking a liquidity premium. Why the full liquidity of all of these assets? What was the thinking behind that?
Well, the primary thinking, and by the way, I do think for many clients, there may well be a place in their asset allocation for illiquid assets, such as some of the ones you've mentioned. But what we're trying to accomplish is to give people a liquid way of investing in assets that will protect them against that inflation risk and where they will get paid while they wait. So this strategy is somewhat unique or differentiated in that we can protect you against inflation in terms of a range of different potential sources of inflation, and that's part of why we have this range of different investments, is it's not always clear where inflation will come from. So we want to make sure that if it's wage-related inflation, that we can actually protect against that, or if it's a commodity-related inflation, we want to be able to manage that risk. So if you think about it, there are a number of different places where you can actually where you could find sources of inflation, and we're trying to provide a single-stop shop that will basically help defend against that. Now, the second reason, by the way, that we want the underlying holdings to be liquid is we think it's a more responsible approach. If we have daily liquidity in the vehicle, we want the underlying assets to also be liquid. We don't want to end up in a situation where our clients might want their money back for other reasons, and where we have illiquid investments that we cannot actually manage that liquidity mismatch. So I think it's A, that it gives us the opportunity to basically match what the clients need in terms of daily liquidity, and B, that we actually think of it as a different part of the asset allocation related to inflation.
So tell us about the composition of the assets. If you were to draw a pie chart of where the fund is right now or is starting its starting point, what would occupy the biggest slice of the pie? Can you give us some percentages as to the asset type, and this will have the lion's share of the pie at whatever percent?
So right now we're most heavily weighted towards the real yield category. So I mentioned those inflation-linked bonds. That's just over a quarter of our asset allocation right now, closely followed by those companies with pricing opportunities. So effectively, the real yield is going to be generating income and also does give you, again, inflation protection. The companies with pricing opportunities are basically global equities where we can actually get capital appreciation. So I mentioned before, we want protection against inflation, but we want to get paid while we wait. And so one of our kind of key goals in this strategy was to avoid it being dead money if you don't have increasing rates of inflation. And these pricing opportunities companies are about a quarter of the portfolio and help deliver on that. And then our third biggest allocation, third, fourth, and fifth largest are commodities, real estate, and listed infrastructure. Let's say they're roughly equally weighted for the other half of the portfolio. So it's a pretty well-balanced mix, and again, is aiming to defend against a range of different sources of inflation.
Talk to us a little bit about the factors that went into to considering this new fund, the deliberations that took place. How does a fund like this come apart? I mean, come together, not come apart. Let's hope it doesn't come apart, Ron. But what are some of the factors that you and your team took into consideration? How was this decided upon? If you can let us, you know, kind of behind the veil a little bit.
Well, I think part one of the discussion is, you know, what is the longevity? Is there an evergreen element to the need for this kind of solution? And if we think about inflation, you know, it's interesting. For the last 8 years, inflation has been one of the last things I was worried about. I was actually more worried about deflation. But in spite of that, at any given point in time, in any economic or investment cycle, people should always be thinking about their need to protect against the risk of inflation. So check mark number one is there a long-term need to think about this solution, i.e. we don't want to create a fund that's for a topic that we won't care about in 6 months. So there's a long-term need to think about inflation. And part two is we've been seeing evidence both cyclically and structurally of increasing risk of inflation. So I just mentioned for the last 8 years I've been more worried about deflation. That has really changed, I would say. In the last 12 to 18 months, my thinking in particular has changed quite a bit. On the cyclical side, we've been seeing increasing wage pressure. So if you look at the U.S., we're now 8 years into an economic recovery, which, by the way, by any standard is already a very long economic recovery, but it's actually been one of the weaker recoveries we've seen in the last 100 years. So we're finally getting to the point in the last 1 to 2 years where the labor market has tightened enough that we're seeing wage pressure basically grinding higher. So just to give you an anecdote, in 2012, wage increases were averaging around 1.5%. By December of 2016, that number was almost 3%. And so we've seen wage pressure grinding higher, but a lot of that wage pressure has actually been obscured by the decline in oil prices. So the collapse in oil from the end of 2014 on into the beginning of 16 basically obscured the inflation risk we were seeing on a cyclical basis. Now, the second part of this is more important. So number one is there a long-term need to think about the problem that this strategy is designed to solve? Number two is, do we see a near-term kind of reason for this to basically be something that clients need to think about? And then number three, the structural point, I think, is particularly compelling right now. And in that regard, you know, this is something we can't say is 100% probability, and in fact, the way we operate is always around probabilities. I look at this structural environment and believe that we might actually indeed be at a change from a world that has been converging to a world that is in divergence. So what do I mean by that? If you look at the last 30 years, global trade policy, global monetary policy, and the movement of capital basically have been liberalized and have converged. So let's dig into that just for a minute. If you think about global trade, we've signed more and more trade agreements for about 30 years that have basically reduced tariffs across the developed economies and the emerging economies. just to give you an anecdote, 30 years ago, the average tariff for goods and services in emerging markets was 30%. Now that's below 10%. So we've opened the world to free trade, which has basically lowered the cost of goods and services and has been deflationary. Number two, we've had convergence in global monetary policy. If you look around the world, 30 years ago, there were very few central banks that were independent, and actually, I think none of them, in fact, had an inflation target. New Zealand was the first central bank to have an inflation target in 1989, and if you look at it today, almost every major central bank in the developed world is not only independent, but also has an inflation target that not coincidentally happens to be 2%. So we've gone from very different approaches to monetary policy to pretty much the same approach across most developed economies, and even in emerging markets, inflation targets and central bank independence have become the norm, and those inflation targets tend to be anywhere up to 4 or 6%. And then the third point is we've had free movement of capital around the world that would arbitrage away any differences between markets. So what you got out of all of that convergence has been a convergence in inflation at very low levels and convergence in interest rates. I believe what we're seeing in the West right now, in Europe and the U.S., is a move from convergence to divergence. The Brexit vote back in June of last year, combined with the U.S. election and the Italian constitutional referendum, I believe were a populist backlash that is only the beginning of a movement away from this convergence, and I do believe protectionism could significantly increase the risk of future inflation, making a strategy like this that much more important for clients.
So you're not a fan of the divergence that you see going on right now. You felt the convergence that you saw where central banks were working in concert together. We have free trade agreements where nations are working in concert to lower tariffs. All of that you consider to be a good thing, it sounds like, and something to where we kind of mastered the system a little bit. And you would prefer that type of system, a coordinated system, to this divergence. Is that correct, Ron?
Well, to be fair, I mean, the answer is yes and no. The answer is yes in that I think in aggregate, the global economy enjoyed higher productivity growth as a result of this system. And effectively, you end up with a better global GDP number. The downside of it is that it actually has caused pain for serious parts, significant parts of the population. So we've examined, for example, if you think about the Midwest and what we always, you know, have called the Rust Belt for some period of time, clearly was a loser from that globalization. And I do think from a policy perspective, many governments actually were enjoying the benefits of higher GDP growth, but failed to adequately basically help people who lost from this trade convergence adjust to that new reality. And so I think part of the backlash is people who say, wait a minute, I was told free trade would be good for me, but it's been anything but good. It's actually been very bad. So I think in net, the convergence could have been good for more people than it was. And unfortunately, that seems to be moving the opposite direction now based on the politics and populism.
Okay. In this opposite direction, you're thinking the hallmarks are there for a trigger for inflation, making this sort of protective type of investing important, or maybe more important than it has been in recent years. Let's talk about deflation for just a minute, because I realize that it looks like deflation is behind us, although very scary there for a while. It was looking like we were headed in that direction. I think there were even some countries in Europe that were experiencing some degree of deflation. Is there any, we know what to do to hedge against inflation. I mean, this real assets fund you're tipping your hat to that, but what about deflation? Is there any tool at all for deflation? As people say, you know, if you think inflation's scary, you know, you should see deflation. We've obviously avoided that over the years, but in the event of deflation, is there any tools in the toolbox for that?
You know, it's a tough question to answer, and I've thought about it a lot in the last 10 years when I was worrying about deflation. The assets that I always came back to as thinking might be a good idea in a deflationary environment, ironically, include some of the same assets we think about in an inflationary environment. So if you imagine a scenario where you go into deflation, the logical response to deflation would be fiscal stimulus from governments, i.e. running large budget deficits, and it would be a response from monetary policy of printing money. So effectively, we saw some of that after the global financial crisis. We saw QE in the U.S., U.K., Europe, and Japan, and we saw fiscal stimulus primarily in the U.S. So in an environment where there's deflation and you have large amounts of money being printed and large fiscal deficits, in theory, you're planting the seeds for future inflation. So you could argue in some level, maybe those hard assets protect you against the aftermath of the responses to deflation. And if they're income producing, then they also might be a good investment during the period of deflation itself. Now, to your question, I don't know that there are many assets that do very well in a period of deflation. So perhaps these hard assets or real assets are actually the least bad investment in that period of time, but it is indeed a tough story if you're worried about deflation to find something that does appreciate in value.
So let's talk about what real assets will, or real asset or two, do you think will perform best over the next 3 to 5 years? And really kind of step outside of the fund for a minute, Ron, because I don't necessarily think that the fund is placing bets quite that way. But in your estimation, in the next 3 to 5 years, can you name a real asset or two that you think is going to do particularly well?
You know, I'm glad you asked the question, because that's part of why we structured the fund the way we did, is because we actually don't know which one will do best. So what we're trying to do here is say, you know, again, I mentioned before a couple of sources. When I think about the different sources of inflation, I tend to think of wages, I think of commodities. It could be demand-driven, where the economy is strong and there's so much demand that prices go up. It could be supply-driven, where supply gets constrained and prices go up. It could be fiscal. It could be, you know, governments having large deficits that then lead the market to believe inflation is coming. Or it could be monetary, of the old adage of too much money chasing too few goods. So I guess part of why we actually did build this strategy with multiple different asset categories is that we felt that it's very difficult to predict which one or two real assets will perform the best and, you know, where that source of inflation would come from that would cause one or two of the real assets to perform best. So I hate to say it, but I actually don't have an answer to that, which is partly reflected in how the allocations are in the portfolio right now based on our market forecast and the probabilities of different scenarios we assess.
Now, is this an open-end or closed-end fund?
It's an open-end fund.
Okay, so what's your starting point right now? What is the total assets in? I realize you guys just launched, but have assets been moved into the fund immediately? Where are you at right now, and where do you think you could be over the next few years?
Yeah, to your point, we just started out of the gate, so the fund is still very small at around $13 million of assets. In terms of potential size, you know, that's always hard to estimate, but when I look at the topic of inflation, given all we discussed about the cyclical and structural considerations, this is something I think, every investor on any given day should be thinking about as part of their discussion around asset allocation, i.e., the questions they should ask should include, how will I generate income, where will I get capital appreciation, and how will I protect my wealth against inflation? So that should always be a discussion point. But now more than at any other point in perhaps the last 8 to 10 years, I think people really need to step back and look at those cyclical pressures on inflation and the structural changes that are underway and think about this as part of their asset allocation. So I guess I look at it and say this could be actually quite a large strategy. And, you know, I don't think there are any particular constraints on capacity. It's a very broad audience, and it's something people should really be considering very carefully.
So with the launch of any new fund, of course, you've got your team of people out there who are expected to sell the fund. It sounds like kind of the summary you just gave, Ron, is kind of the argument that they would make or the case that they would make to clients as to why they should be participating in this particular fund at this particular time. Is that, or would you add anything to that in terms of what your team has been told, your frontline people, about how this is presented to clients? I realize that might be a little bit of a sensitive question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What do you think?
No, not sensitive at all. I think, again, okay. This is something where intellectually I genuinely believe what I've been saying about the cyclical risk and the structural risk, and that is indeed something I've discussed with our marketing force, because I think that's a conversation they should have with clients regardless of whether we're launching the strategy or not. So our goal as a firm is to be a trusted independent advisor to clients, and to basically, you know, help them meet their goals. So even if we were not launching the strategy, this is something they should be talking about. And, you know, the other thing, again, I think that we're discussing is that this is, we believe, a differentiated strategy because it does have a multifaceted approach to dealing with the problem of inflation. And unlike, I think, many other strategies, does give you capital appreciation and income generation if, you know, if there is an inflation. So we're kind of a little bit of a hedge. If there is an inflation, you're still going to get some returns. You're not basically, you know, you're getting paid while you wait. And so one last thing I'll say on that is we've been really excited by the amount of interest we've seen across a range of different channels, too. This is, you know, whether it be high net worth individuals or institutional investors, there is a lot of interest because people are basically thinking more about that inflation risk and recognizing that maybe they need to go back, you know, basically take a second look at their asset allocation and decide if they're appropriately positioned or not. And hopefully we can help them solve that problem.
So no doubt you've got some kind of target for this fund. Can you let us in on that? Where are you supposed to be in 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years? Can you share that, or am I getting into proprietary territory here?
I don't think we really have any particular target in terms of assets under management. Obviously, we want to, you know, find clients who are trying to achieve what this strategy is designed to do and make sure that the solution matches the problem. So as long as we can do that, you know, hopefully it will grow and we'll be happy. And the thing that will make us even happier is when we deliver on the expectations for clients, which we'll do our best to do.
So let's talk about the yardstick for success then. In 2 years, what would the yardstick be? Would it be assets under management? Would it be the return that you're getting? I mean, what are the metrics that you'll look at and other people at Lazard will be looking at to say the fund is knocking it out of the park, or the fund has been tepid, or the fund is really not doing anywhere near what we expected? What are the metrics?
Well, I guess one of the primary metrics will be just the benchmark itself. So we basically established as a benchmark that we want to beat a combination of the MSCI World Hedge and the Bloomberg Barclays World Government Inflation-Linked Hedged Blended Index. I know that's a mouthful, but basically we look at it as 70-30. Basically, we want to basically deliver a better return than a combination of equities and inflation-linked bonds. And then as a secondary measure, we're looking at our performance against CPI. And so what we'll be doing, and this is basically how we evaluate all of our portfolio managers, is looking and saying, okay, what is your established benchmark in terms of performance? What is your objective you've stated to clients? Obviously, defending them against inflation and getting paid while you wait. And so the first evaluation will be, did we do what we were endeavoring to do in terms of the performance of the strategy? Now, our belief is if you actually do that and there is a legitimate problem to be solved, i.e. protecting your capital against inflation, that the assets under management will come as a result. So I tend to think of them as kind of hand in hand, but if we deliver on the performance that we hope to do, then hopefully we will see the assets come afterwards.
My guest has been Ron Temple. He's Managing Director and Co-Head of Multi-Asset Investing at Lazard Asset Management, which has more than $4.2 billion in assets under management currently. Ron, thanks a lot for taking the time, and good luck with the new fund.
Thank you very much.